This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment's Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. A mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible. Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters Wednesday, April 17th.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for being with us again. In recent years, we've heard a lot of discussions about worldview. That is the lens through which we evaluate and we interpret what is going on in the world around us and what it means in our lives. But what is your worldview and how can you test it? Why is that important ultimately? That's what we're going to talk about today with Dr. Tawa Anderson, who is Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Honor Program at Oklahoma Baptist University. He is co-author of the new book we're going to talk about called An Introduction to Christian Worldview, Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World. Dr. Anderson, it's great to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. This is a great topic. I'm excited to talk about it with you. You say, and I think this is an interesting opening line you have here right at the outset, you say that worldview is a contentious term, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Why do you think it is?
Probably some historical reasons for it. The term itself doesn't really arise until the late 18th century. And so for some lay Christians and Christian scholars even, they have this notion that, well, you know, if worldview as a term and as a discipline doesn't arise until so late, then there's something suspect about it. Two of the other reasons why it can be contentious, there's a lot of thought that maybe worldview is an overly rationalized construct that is just talking about, you know, we need to have the right beliefs. So talking about a Christian worldview is about thinking the right things and having the right beliefs. And that, of course, is not at all what we want to be all about as believers. We do want to have right beliefs, obviously, orthodoxy. Right. But we also want to be about right practice and right engagement, orthopraxy. So these misconceptions of worldview make it a contentious term. And then third and finally, I think just the fact that worldview is utilized in a lot of secular disciplines from a non-Christian perspective, again, for some Christians, makes it a contentious term.
Yeah. Now, I'm very interested in the first thing that you mentioned, the fact that worldview arose in the late 18th century, because I didn't know it was so long ago. It seems like we've only been discussing worldview in Christian circles with great vigor for the last decade, maybe couple of decades. What was the genesis of the term itself? Where did that come from and who came up with it?
It stems from Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher in the late 18th century, and he used it as just kind of a perspective, as it were, a person's perception of the world around them, from the German word Weltanschauung, which just means view of the world. But it very, very quickly after Kant used it, spread through other German philosophers and very quickly into other European countries, and oftentimes just incorporated as a loan word. They'd use the German Weltanschauung for what they were talking about, but also quickly became transliterated in Danish and then in English and in French. And it came into evangelical circles in the later 1800s, so, you know, 75, 85 years after Kant, through James Orr, and then, of course, in the early 20th century, Abraham Kuyper, the great Dutch theologian and statesman, worldview thinking was very, very prominent in his kind of circles. So even though it has its origins in German philosophy, its introduction into kind of the Protestant or evangelical world is really through Kuyper and his disciples in the Dutch Reformed tradition.
Very interesting. So now when we're talking about a Christian worldview, clearly we understand, because we know the differences between Orthodox Christianity and the other world religions, not to mention all the sects and all the cults that are out there. What is the difference fundamentally between the Christian worldview and all other worldviews? Would you lump them in two categories? Would you give them multiple categories? How would you systematize them, in other words?
You can effectively do it in both ways. I've heard it put, and we don't put it this way on our book, but I think it's an effective way of saying it, that you ultimately have two worldviews, worldviews that are oriented around a recognition and submission to the triune God, and worldviews that are human-centered. So I think that's a fair way of putting it, that you've got Christian worldview and then non-Christian worldviews. But you can also categorize worldviews according to their understanding of, as it were, kind of prime reality or what is ultimate reality. And so you can have theistic worldviews, of which Christianity is one, but other theistic worldviews would also include Islam and Judaism. So there are a lot of kind of points in common in those worldviews in terms of recognizing that there is a transcendent being, that this transcendent being created the universe. So we share those worldview components, but of course then we differ radically in other core worldview areas.
Right. I think that's a perfect way of explaining it. You can simplify it and say there's the Christian worldview and all the other wrong worldviews, human-centered worldviews. But yes, you can actually break that down, as you mentioned before, into different particular religions and particular views of God, theistic, atheistic, and so forth. I'm curious what you might say is the most dominant worldview that's in play right now in the United States. What is it? Postmodernism? Would you say it's secularism, humanistic, pagan? How would you characterize it?
Well, one of the reasons we subtitled the book, Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World, is because we perceive in the Western world, including in the United States, just a radical pluralism of worldviews. And so identifying a dominant worldview is very difficult. If I was to identify a dominant worldview stream, now understanding this isn't, in my mind, an overarching worldview, right? An overarching worldview answers all of kind of the fundamental worldview questions. What is our nature? What is our world? What is our problem? What is our end? So this is, as it were, kind of a worldview thread, a thread that goes through many different worldviews. But I think egoism is kind of a primary or predominant worldview in the United States, and that's just a self-centeredness, that I am ultimately what matters. But that kind of egoism can exist within a lot of different kind of overarching philosophical or religious worldviews. And one of the things that concerns me as a Christian teacher and minister is the egoism that we sometimes see creeping into the Christian church, yeah, where we think it's all about me, it's about what I need or what I desire. You know, I do my church shopping based on my needs and the programs that I want to see or the preaching that I like. And so then, of course, I'm sorry, I'm rambling here a little bit.
No, you're great. You're great.
Of evaluating our own worldview, and if we desire to have a Christian worldview, then being aware of those worldview influences upon us can help us to see that that kind of egoism just does not fit at all with biblical Christianity, and we can become more aware of that. Sorry, the original question was, what worldviews do we see predominant in the United States? So that egoism is a thread that I see as predominant. If I'm to talk about overarching philosophical and religious worldviews, postmodernism, I think, is one. Naturalism is another. Mm-hmm. And in the academic world, I think that's the dominant one. And Christian theism is the third. So I think those are probably the three predominant worldviews, but again, in a very pluralistic kind of society.
Right. Now, I want to get into, when we come back from the break, I want to get into these questions that you asked that are really the questions we have to get answers to determine our individual and maybe our corporate worldviews. But when you say that egoism is a problem within the church today, and I heartily agree with you on that, what are the roots of that? How is it that people who claim to be Christians and are expected to have a Christian worldview based on what they profess as believers in Jesus Christ could incorporate a form of egoism, as you mentioned, as a worldview thread and try to really do a syncretistic blend with Christianity when the whole thrust of Christianity is deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me?
That's an excellent question. And I wonder the same. I have ideas, but that's all that they really are. And one of the things, though, that I am confident of is that throughout history, the Christian church has always been influenced by cultural and intellectual streams around it, even when those streams of thought are non-Christian or just outright pagan and anti-Christian in nature. Right. And this happens, I think, in the 20th and 21st centuries by kind of the egoism that's dominant outside of us just creeping in, whether it's through advertising or commercialism. And so it's in an unconscious way that I think most Christians absorb that egoism into their worldview. Again, if worldview is formed, as we argue that it is, on a pre-theoretical level, meaning that we're not thinking about it while our worldview is developing, then these non-Christian influences become a part of our worldview and we don't even realize it. So for a lot of Christians, again, they're just unaware that there are these alien elements in their worldview, and they think that they're just holding a Christian worldview. For example, I think this is fascinating, but studies show that about, I think it's 65 or 70% of American evangelicals believe that there's a Bible verse that says God helps those who help themselves.
Ah, yeah, doesn't that drive you crazy? Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Dr. Tawa Anderson. An Introduction to Christian Worldview is his book, and we'll return right after this on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
This Easter, from 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment comes Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. When Joy Smith's son John falls through an icy Missouri lake, all hope seems lost. But a mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible.
Please, God, send your Holy Spirit to save my son.
Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters Wednesday, April 17th. Tickets and showtimes available at BreakthroughMovie.com.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Dr. Tawa Anderson, who is Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Honor Program at Oklahoma Baptist University, and he is co-author of the new book, An Introduction to Christian Worldview, Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World. You shared a statistic, Dr. Anderson, before we went to the break, which really hits home with me when you cite this, because I've heard this before, that some number between 65 and 70% of American evangelicals believe there's a Bible verse that says God helps those who help themselves. Which just proves that we don't know our Bibles, right? That's the crux of it, the crux of the problem.
Yeah, and if we hold a Christian worldview, then supposedly it should be founded on God's self-revelation in Scripture. And so if we don't know what Scripture does and doesn't say, we need to ask ourselves the question, how Christian is my Christian worldview?
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about some of these core worldview questions that you talk about in the book that you say are at the heart of every single worldview. Beginning with this question, what is our nature? Break this down a little bit, because as you're walking through these questions, it really answers a lot of the mysteries for people about how to unlock a worldview and figure out what it exactly is. But for the Christian, we know that our nature is sinful. What more should we know in order to really have a truly biblical worldview?
Well, Pascal puts his finger on it very well. He says, man is both the most noble and the most depraved of all creatures. And so the depraved side is the fact that we are fallen,
right?
That we were created in the image of God. That's the noble side. So we're the most noble of all creatures because we alone bear that image of God. But because of the fall, we are radically depraved. And so we're separated from God. And we're just utterly sinful and incapable of doing anything on our own about it. So that dual notion that we're created in God's image and therefore we have inherent dignity and worth and value, but we're also fallen and because of that capable of the greatest evils, those I think are two of the absolutely crucial things we need to understand about our nature.
That's perfect. Now, how would that go over and against some other worldviews when you look at the egoism in the worldviews that you've talked about, postmodern? worldview, for example, or the naturalistic worldview, they certainly wouldn't take the view that we are, they might say we're dignified, but they certainly wouldn't say that we're fallen.
That's right. So they'll emphasize one side or the other. And all three of the worldviews that you mentioned, well, yeah, they'll emphasize the goodness or the greatness of man, but will totally overlook the fall. And a lot of really horrific worldview implications historically have stemmed from that, including, in my mind, things like the French Revolution, the Communist Revolution, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's philosophy that said, you know, man is just good, and if we could just get rid of corrupt institutions like the church and government, all things would be fine. Well, no, anarchism and communism, because of the sinfulness of human people, end up being even worse than the things that were potentially problematic before them.
Right. Not to mention the fact that the church and the government are made up of people. So how in the world?
Yes.
You got the same problem there when you have people involved. Yep. Yeah. So true. All right. And then when you get to the question, what is our world? The Christian, obviously, we know that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There is a divine creator. And we understand from the first chapter of the Gospel of John, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The nature of the Trinity in creation. This is opposed, obviously, to the postmodern view, the naturalistic worldview. And what difference does this make? Because when you have someone, for example, who embraces Darwinian evolution and is a naturalist and takes out of the equation the dignity of man as formed in God's image, this changes everything, because all of a sudden you don't have the same moral standard, right? You're not held to the same moral standard that a Christian would espouse.
Absolutely. And that's one of the areas where worldview consistency also comes into play. You put your finger on a couple of things that exist in a naturalistic worldview. One is that, you know, when we talk about what is our nature, a naturalist will usually say that, you know, man has this inherent dignity and worth, and we're very good and very great creatures. But then they'll turn around and say that the world is an accident, right? It's not created, it's not designed, it doesn't have any purpose or any meaning. We're just a great cosmic accident, which fundamentally undermines any notion of inherent value or dignity or worth in human beings. There's no foundation on which to build or to assume that value and dignity and worth. And so the worldview ends up being inconsistent within itself. But nonetheless, that is what they're going to argue, that we are just a cosmic accident. So, right. And that, again, is one of the fundamental differences in a Christian worldview and most other contemporary worldviews in America, is are we here on purpose or not? Is the world designed and ordered by God, or is it just the result of a cosmic accident, for lack of a better word?
Yeah. So now when you look at some of these non-Christian worldviews, do you find it pretty easy to detect or pinpoint these worldview inconsistencies?
Yes, and particularly once we've learned to use some of those worldview tools, which I think are essential for Christians particularly to learn to use. Because by and large, people are not aware of the inconsistencies in their own worldviews, because it's just the way that they've always looked at the world around them.
Yeah.
And it takes somebody outside of themselves to look at their worldview and point out some of these inconsistencies. So one of the things I think that we can do as believers is learn these tools for worldview analysis. Learn how to look at the worldviews that our friends and our neighbors and our coworkers have and point out these inconsistencies and say, maybe you should be looking at something else.
Yes.
Maybe you should be looking towards Christ.
Yeah, exactly. So when you talk about determining the truthfulness of a worldview, you discuss internal truthfulness, you know, external factors and existential consistency. For example, if you were to look at postmodernism, how would you apply those standards, looking at the internal, the external, and the existential consistencies, and being able to explain to a postmodernist, here's where your worldview comes apart?
Well, on the first step, internal consistency, one of the fundamental concepts in postmodernism is a denial of objective truth, or the correspondence theory of truth. We should back up and say postmodernism is a pretty slippery fish and really hard to define, but virtually everybody will acknowledge that this is one of the essential elements of postmodernism, is just the denial of objective truth, that there is a way the world really is and that we can come to understand that way that the world really is. And so if a postmodernist denies the existence of objective truth, then the question becomes, well, is it true that there is no truth? Right? Well, and if it's true that there is no truth, then there is truth. There's at least one truth, namely that there is no truth.
Yes.
Right. But if it's not true that there is no truth, well, then it's not true and we don't have to worry about it. So internally, there's a lot more involved in that, of course, but internally, the worldview ends up being inconsistent because it insists that there is no truth And that holds for everybody. That's true for everybody. It's not just true for a postmodernist. It's also true for people that think there is no truth. It's true for us that there is no truth. Yeah. And so it's just internally inconsistent. It's like cutting off the branch that you're sitting on. In philosophy, we call it self-referential absurdity.
Yeah.
So it can't live up to its own standards. It violates itself. It contradicts itself as a worldview.
Well, right. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is we have this LGBT madness all around us all the time. And now we're being told a boy can be a girl and a girl can be a boy. And there's no such thing as gender and all the rest.
Yeah.
Now, we're into the deep weeds of insanity at this point. And I think it frustrates a lot of Christians I've talked to. How do you respond to the insane? Because you continue to put forward a biblical worldview and say, no, God created the male and female. This is biologically obvious. This is sociologically obvious. How do you deal with those sorts of issues when you begin to see a worldview truly jump the shark, as it were?
Yeah, and I mean, it can be hard, particularly with somebody who embraces that kind of perspective that, you know, we can define our own gender on our account. But one of the things that I like to do is just to try to trace back to what else has to be true for you to be able to define your own gender, right?
Well, right.
It builds directly out of a postmodern worldview that rejects the existence of objective truth, right? If
right.
there is no objective reality, then there is no objective gender that I have to live within. I can define my own gender. I create my own truth, right?
Right.
So if somebody's going to embrace that perspective, it's got to be supported by a postmodern perspective. Now, once you uncover the postmodern assumptions that lie behind it, and you ask a person, well, do you really acknowledge that? Do you think that somebody can define their own reality? So, for example, even though, you know, I'm of Swedish-Canadian descent, I could say, well, no, really, I want to be a black woman. Well, no, you can't be a black woman. Well, why not? Because you're not black.
Right.
But what if I say, but I want to be black. That's how I want to define myself. And so that's my reality. Just the same way that you want to be a girl, not a boy, I want to be black, not white. And who are you to tell me that I can't be? And they would say, well, the fact is that you're not black. But in order to say that, you have to acknowledge the existence of objective truth.
Yes. Yes.
Right? And if there is objective truth, then the postmodern foundation upon which the gender bending is based isn't accurate. It's not the right perception of reality. And so you can't use that as a means to go in that direction.
Well,
so I want to try to trace back to the philosophical foundation upon which the craziness around us is built and say there's something wrong with those philosophical foundations. And so the craziness shouldn't even be happening.
That's excellent. I love that, how you've unpacked it in that way, because that makes a lot of sense. Why, you know, moving somebody through this denial of objective truth and explaining how ultimately that's a logical fallacy. And what's interesting is when you meet people who have that worldview, they are very emphatic and very morally judgmental if you hold a contrary view. So that also seems to be an inconsistency that you can point out.
Yeah. And it is, and you're absolutely right. And this is why, and we don't really do this in the book, but in my classes here, I regularly tell my students that the vast majority of Americans profess to a sort of relativism, either moral relativism specifically or just relativism regarding truth in general. But I said virtually none of them actually are relativists. They just think they are, and it's a popular view to hold. But once you actually start pushing against their position, and asking them, you know, can I really just say that I'm black? I'm not white. I'm black. I want to be black. I don't want to be white. They'll say, no, that's foolish. Or if I say, well, is it really, you know, you think it's wrong to try to exterminate an entire people group, but what if Hitler thought it was right, so it was right for him, so that was his moral truth? Well, no, genocide is just wrong. So again, they think they're relativists, but they're not. And really the first step in helping eliminate some of the craziness in our society is helping people who think they're relativists realize that they're really not.
Really good. Well, a really good book too, An Introduction to Christian Worldview, Dr. Tawa Anderson. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson. It was great to have you here.
Absolutely my pleasure, Janet.
All right. God bless you. And we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment's Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. A mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible. Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters Wednesday, April 17th. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Parenting is such a monumental task. It's wonderful and tiring and all-consuming and a great blessing all at the same time. Yet who among us doesn't have some regrets about the way we have blown it with our kids in some situations? I certainly do. And my next guest says he can also identify with that and has put together a book to help parents learn from their mistakes or the mistakes of others in order to do a better job raising their children. So joining me now is Jonathan McKee. He has over 20 years of youth ministry experience and speaks to parents and leaders worldwide, and we're going to be discussing his book, If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, Seven Vital Changes I'd Make. And it's great to have you here. Jonathan, how are you?
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You say you're the perfect example of an imperfect parent. Why do you say that?
Because I'm honest.
Honest man.
Introduce me to a perfect parent. I'd love to meet one.
Yeah,
I think, you know, maybe as parents, we might think we're pretty good, at least until we have teenagers. And then we're humbled. We realize we know nothing.
Oh, amen
but,
to that.
My wife and I, we're actually empty nesters now. My kids are 19, 21, and 23. And as a matter of fact, one of them's back for Easter break right now. It's fun. They're boomerang kids. You send them out and they come back. I tell you, parenting ain't over. That's one thing we have learned. It doesn't end for sure. And we're just like a lot of parents, I think, in our boat at this time now, which is when we have these conversations with them, sometimes we get off the phone, like they call us from the college dorm, and we have a conversation. Then my wife and I look at each other and we say, wow, did we do everything right? Did we equip them for these decisions? And I think, like a lot of parents, we kind of look back and go, man, I tell you, if I had it to do over again, I would do, you know, fill in the blank. And that's kind of how this book started. It was by talking with so many parents who, even in the middle of parenting, it's amazing how much parents adjust and go, wow, I wouldn't do that again. And kind of sometimes even parent their younger kids differently, right?
Or
their younger kids probably complain about that. They say, well, how come, you know,
I didn't get away with that.
How come she gets to do that, right?
Yep.
So that's a lot of where this came from. And that kind of actually opened the doors to the poll I took at a lot of my parenting workshops and to my readers, asked hundreds of parents one question. I said, if you could go back in time and change one parenting practice, what would you do over? And man, the responses were eye-opening.
Absolutely. And I want to dive into that. I'm curious just to ask you, though, what would you say is your biggest do-over?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, it's funny because in the book, obviously, I talked about seven vital changes I'd make. I think the biggest one for me is I think less would be more. I think I would talk less. I think I would react less. My temper. You know, there's times where kids get mad, and sometimes we tell ourselves, we need to teach them this lesson. And sometimes natural consequences would have done good. And I'm, don't get me wrong, I'm very clear in the book. That doesn't mean let your kids do whatever they want.
Right.
By far, not
right.
That at all. But for me, not, you know, so focused on boundaries that it hindered bonding.
Yeah, that's really good. And as you say, you had a lot of different responses when you did the poll. Parents shared a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Were there more on the side of, I should have done this more, or more on the side of, I should have done less of that?
Yeah, you know, it was crazy because in a world where, you know, probably the number one issue parents are dealing with right now is that stupid phone that their kids got in their pocket, you know?
Yes.
I mean, so the reaction that a lot of parents are having every time at my parent workshops, the thing they want to talk about is, what do I do with social media? What do I do with this phone? And the typical reaction tends to be, we need to have more boundaries. We need to tighten down, stop giving our kids phones. We need to not let them on social media. We need to, you know, boundary, rule. And when it came to looking back, the overwhelming regret that parents had, more than any other response I received, was, I wish I'd spent more time with my kids. I wish we'd had more family dinners. more time in conversation, less time in front of the TV. One mom said, with a do-over, I'd jump in the ocean with them more instead of sitting in the sand watching them play. It was the overwhelming response of, I wish I would have, you know, spent time going up and kissing them goodnight and having those conversations bedside, you know, tucking them in. Less than 2% of parents actually said, I wish I would have had more boundaries.
Oh,
less
wow.
than 2%.
That's telling. That's telling. Well, you know, and I related when you talk about parents who say, but I was so tired. I was doing so much. I had so many kids. I was trying to. I think this is a very common refrain with a lot of parents is they say, a lot of my parenting is all I could manage at the time because I was so overloaded and I meant well, but I think I blew it and I'm kicking myself because I should have done this. I should have done this. What about easing the burden on parents of saying nobody's perfect? You can't go back, number one. And number two, you know, sometimes what you did in the moment might not have been perfect, but could you have done better in that moment looking back? You know what I'm saying? Like the hardness that we have on ourselves sometimes can be overdone.
Well, I mean, and God is the architect of new beginnings. I mean, whenever somebody was feeling that kind of burden that came up to Jesus, Jesus constantly was like, you know, hey, let's not worry about your past. Let's talk about your future. And that's the good news for parents is so many of us could burden ourselves with guilt and regret, and it's not too late. I mean, even for empty nesters out there, it's not too late to bond with your kid, even if they're on their own, if they're in a dorm or army barracks or just living on their own somewhere, you know, across the country. It's not too late to restore that relationship, and you still can have an incredible impact. You know, I mean, here I am, I'm 46 years old, I've only got one teenager left. I'm almost best friends with my dad. We go out to dinner, you know, once a week, and he lives around the corner, and we spend tons of time. And I don't think I would have ever guessed that when I was in high school, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I liked my dad. He was cool and all. But, I mean, you know, those parent relationships can be lifetime relationships. And for parents, it's so important to not neglect that bonding. And boundaries are just as important. But it's amazing how many parents get so caught up in boundaries that it hinders bonding and they don't even concentrate on that.
That's so good. How do you advise parents to handle both of those things in a good way, the bonding and the boundaries?
Yeah, wouldn't it be perfect if there was a you know, perfect recipe for how that balance looks and day to day, you know?
Yeah.
And it's my first chapter where I talk about tipping the scales. One thing I really do is I try to enforce the parents that, you know, especially the parents that, you know, we say, man, we want our kids to learn these values, you know? We want them to learn. And sometimes we think the answer to that is through stricter rules. And again, as good as boundaries are, and man, anybody who reads my book will realize, man, this guy, when it comes to social media, when it comes to all this stuff, I'm actually pretty strict. I'm one of those guys who's like, stop giving your young kids devices. I'm pretty strict when they're young, but then I believe in, you know, loosening up as they get older. But as important as boundaries are, the thing that a lot of parents look back on and regret is that so many values are passed down through conversations.
Yeah.
And when parents are so focused on boundaries and that all they are is that drill sergeant, whatever, what happens is they, you know, if they aren't having those conversations, if our kids don't feel safe to open up to us, then we're going to miss key opportunities to walk through life with them and teach them discernment. Or in other words, when mom or dad doesn't have a relationship with their kids, their kids tend to glean values and behaviors from other sources, and that's frightening.
That's true. That's true. You need to dig in the time. You need to put in the time getting to know your kids. I think maybe some parents fall into the trap of thinking, I know my kid. I know my kid. He's my flesh and blood. You know, I don't need to spend that much time talking to him. He doesn't have much to say to me anyway. But doesn't that grow out of the bonding, the willingness of the child to talk and open up?
It is, and when they feel safe, you know, and again, it's not because we let them do whatever they want, but when we are really being proactive about this, and you know, it's funny, being in youth ministry for over 20 years, you talk with a lot of youth workers, and youth workers sometimes will even ask kids, they'll say, you know, hey, what's your number one complaint about, you know, parents, or if you could tell your parents one thing and you know they'd listen, what would you hear? And I've taken those polls personally. Number one answer I always hear from young people is, listen to me. You know, notice me. And it's funny because parents do complain, hey, my kid you know, won't talk with me. I wrote a book called Get Your Teenager Talking, because parents constantly feel that, hey, my kid has one word answers to every question I ask, you know. But the funny thing is, I can talk with a kid for 5 minutes because I go and I speak at school assemblies, whatever. And I actually play a little game. My game is to, within 5 minutes, to get this kid to find out what it is that this kid wants to talk about and free them up to talk about that thing.
We're going to take a quick break. Jonathan McKee, If I Had a Parenting Do-Over. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. This is Janet Mefford for Preborn. Nearly 1 in 4 pregnancies in America will end in abortion. The Ministry of Preborn provides free ultrasounds for abortion-minded women nationwide. When a mother sees her baby on an ultrasound and hears the baby's heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to choose life. Here's the story of a mom who went to one of Preborn's centers and met the baby she had planned to abort.
They took me to the back and they introduced me to my child for the first time through an ultrasound. I was able to see this life growing inside of me, hear the heartbeat, and nothing else mattered at that point. I was a mother to be.
Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of 5 ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. You can help save a baby's life by donating to Preborn. To donate, call now 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com.
This Easter, from 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment comes Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. When Joy Smith's son John falls through an icy Missouri lake, all hope seems lost. But a mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible.
Please, God, send your Holy Spirit to save my son.
Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters Wednesday, April 17th. Tickets and showtimes available at breakthroughmovie.com.
Hello, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. Jesus brought light into a dark world. When we were hopeless in our sin, He made the ultimate sacrifice on the cross. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. But He rose again after 3 days and was seen by hundreds of His followers. All of us at Focus on the Family wish you a wonderful Easter. But more importantly, share God's miraculous gift with others, telling the good news that Jesus has risen so that we could have eternal life.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us. And we are also joined by Jonathan McKee, author and youth culture expert, author of If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, 7 Vital Changes I Would Make. And I think this is just such a great subject for every Christian parent to hear some of this advice that Jonathan is giving to all of us. Another one that you've talked about in the book is not sweating the small stuff, how to let things go. That can be a real difficult one. I think for a lot of parents, I've struggled with that a little bit. What hill do you die on? How do you guide people on that?
Well, it's so hard because, I mean, in the moment as a parent, especially, man, when you parent teenagers, that is, talk about a humbling experience. I mean, that is so
yes.
difficult because, you know, we can constantly talk with them and no matter what we say, we're wrong, right? And they're
yes.
going to correct us on it and that. And so it's tough because, you know, sometimes we feel like, okay, there's disrespect or disobedience. And I know that a lot of parents, they looked back at the, you know, the fights over, you know, did you brush your teeth? I had a good friend who, you know, told his daughter, hey, you know, stop throwing your towel on the ground when you're doing the shower. Why don't you hang it up and put it away? And he said, man, I tell you, I tell her that every day. He goes, if I don't go in there and make her do that, he goes, at the end of 12 days, there will be 12 towels in a stack in her bedroom. And he was all upset. And he's like, you know, this is disobedience. This is it. And it was funny. And I literally looked at him. And after, you know, having just gone through parenting and looking and dealing with so many parents with so many of these issues, I looked at him. I said, hey, How's your daughter's attitude? Must have, it's pretty good. What are her grades like? Well, actually, she's getting a 4.0. Does she smoke like pot, like around the house? Is she you know, carrying weapons? I'm just, you know, no, of course, no. I'm like, well, I'll tell you what. The next time she doesn't put the towel away, hand her a box of Tide, tell her to do her own laundry, and let it go.
There you go.
Because you've got a good kid. And the thing is, sometimes we, you know, don't even think about the fact that natural consequences can teach far more than any of our lectures. You know, if your kid you know, if you say grab a coat and they're like, I don't need a coat, you know, that's one of those battles I would have fought, where now I look back and go, you know what? Let them freeze for a day. They'll remember their coat the next day without you reminding them, you know?
Right.
And there's things in the book I, you know, go through how some ways, how do you spot this in the moment? How do you let your pride drop, and how do you, you know, kind of pause and think through these things? Because a lot of parents had regrets in that area of, man, I should have, you know, they afterwards go, I don't think I should have done that. That was a bad move. I should have let that go.
We all have those moments. I was thinking when you were using that analogy, I have the same theory with lunches and forgetting lunches.
Yeah.
And I have one particular child whose name I will not give, who is prone to forgetting lunch. And finally, I said, this is the last time. And I only did it a few times where I brought the lunch over to school. I said, this is the last time it's going to happen. The next time the lunch is forgotten, you will be hungry. And that solved it. But that kind of gets to another point that you bring up in the book, which is gradually decreasing boundaries and gradually increasing freedom. Showing those consequences is also important for kids to learn how to stand on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's you know, I'm actually a big advocate of when they're young, being pretty strict with them. And I you know, I talk about in the book kind of what that looks like day to day, especially in a world, you know, now where young people have technology and stuff.
Right.
I think it's great for you to sit your 12-year-old down and, you know, and when, you know, every single, you know, 8 and 10-year-old out there has already got their phone with social media and everything. And if, you know, if your 11-year-old comes up and says, well, I want to be on Snapchat,
right,
you know, it's good for us, the parents, one, to be aware of what's going on. And if we're aware, for example, that COPPA, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, says you can't be on Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook until you're age 13, it's very easy as a parent to say, sorry, you're not 13.
Yeah.
You can't be on that.
Okay.
And a lot of parents, one, don't even know that. Two, aren't willing to have that conversation because, sure enough, their kid's saying, well, every one of my friends, and we're talking every one of their friends at church has, you know, Snapchat and is on social media. And that makes it difficult because, you know, your kid's the only 11-year-old, the only 12-year-old who didn't lie about their age to get onto those things. And it's tough, but there's times like that where, as parents, we need to be strict. But I let my kids know. And I didn't do this till my last two kids that I kind of learned the hard way with my oldest. And I basically sat them down. I said, hey, I might seem really strict right now. I said, but I want you to know, my goal is by your senior year of high school that you're going to have no rules. And right now, you might think I'm the strictest dad on the block, but my goal is that senior year, your friends are going to be jealous of what you get to do because I want you to be making your own decisions. And I kept true to my word. And it was interesting because they even forgot as they're 17, 17 and a half, and they'd come and go, Dad, you know, can I go here with my friends? I'm like, I don't know. Can you? Well, you think you should? And it was funny because then they started coming to me for advice.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it because they had permission. And a lot of parents don't have their eyes on the calendar. And I made this mistake with my oldest. And we forget that when they're 18 and they're in a dorm, or, you know, across the country or in an army barracks, chances are they're not going to call us up and say, hey, Dad, everybody else is watching Game of Thrones. Can I watch it?
That's right.
They're going to make that decision by themselves.
Yes,
and the only question we need to ask as parents is, are we equipping them for that day to make that decision?
That's excellent. How do you advise parents to learn how to give freedom in appropriate quantities? This is always something that we're walking the tightrope on. Well, I don't want to give too much freedom, but I don't want to restrict too much. But you're right. I'm with you completely that you need to have rules and boundaries and be stricter when they're younger so they, you know, will learn how to do the right thing. What about how much freedom is too much freedom?
Yeah, well, and that's a great question. And I'll say again, there's no magic recipe. I mean, in the book, I give specific advice of here's what this could look like with your sophomore, with your junior, with your senior. But it's funny, you get five sets of amazing parents on your show, and you ask them all about what are the practices you should do. They're all going to agree on bonding. They're all going to absolutely agree. As a matter of fact, every parenting expert out there says more conversations. But when it comes to boundaries, nobody agrees.
Wow.
Nobody agrees. It's amazing. You get five of the best sets of parents and you ask them all, what time do you make your kids go to bed? One's going to say, we don't have a bedtime. One's going to say 9 o'clock because they need those 9 hours and a quarter recommended by the National Sleep Foundation. Somebody else will be like, I don't know. It depends on their homework load. Everybody's going to be different. And that's the tough thing in parenting. And rather than being that strict rule, you know, one of the recommendations I really make for parents is walking with them through this. Because there's times where you're not going to know the answer. Your kid's going to come up and ask about some new app that you've never even heard of before. And can I have that? And rather than, you know, just quickly, no, because apps are bad, you know, or rather than, sure, do whatever you want. Sometimes the answer is, I don't know, let's check it out together.
Okay.
And that way you're walking with them through some of these decisions. And it's cool because that whole process of teaching them how to think and teach them how to look and tap into their own values and morals and what the Bible says to make those decisions is the process that hopefully they'll do when they're on their own.
That's so true. When you talk about passing on Christian values to your kids, all Christian parents want their kids to be saved and to follow Jesus and to live lives that please the Lord. That's not something you can control, though. That is from day one, regardless of how much you love that baby who's in your arms, that is an individual human being with his own will and his own, you know, walk and all the rest and all the factors that come into play. What about really having an impact on your child for Christ? What would you advise Christian parents to do?
Well, and that's where I really, in the final chapter, tried to talk about what that looks like. It's kind of Deuteronomy 6 in action. It's walking with our kids. And if we want to impress these values, this truth, this biblical truth on our kids, what's it look like? It's actually not through being super strict, and it's not through letting them do whatever they want. It's through walking with them along the road as they get up, as they go to bed at night. Because, man, I promise you, this world is full of lies.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, last year, the word of the year, according to the Oxford Dictionary, was post-truth. That was the word of the year. And Oxford always looks at our society and goes, what's the word that represents, you know, like a couple years ago, it was selfie, you know, that represents our society. And this past year, it was post-truth. And their definition basically is, forget the facts. What feels right? And that's really a good representation of what our society is teaching young people right now. What feels good at the moment? It takes a parent who's walking with their kid, talking with them about this stuff all the time, keeping those open conversations in their kids' lives. This takes effort. This takes work. There is no quick fix. There is no app that where you just monitor your kids on this. This is good old-fashioned face-to-face conversations, hanging out with our kids. And that's why I spend that whole chapter just talking about that, because what that looks like today in a world so full of lies, being that beacon of truth, it's our calling as a parent.
It really is. It's such good advice, Jonathan. You've got so much good stuff packed into this book, and advice about dealing with anger and pressing pause and noticing your kids and so many good things that I think are really going to help a lot of parents bond and be able to raise their children in a way that really is successful and in a godly fashion. It's such a good book. It's called If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, 7 Vital Changes I'd Make. Jonathan McKee with us, and so good to talk to you. Thank you, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, you take care. And thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. Always a pleasure to be with you. God bless you, and we'll see you again next time.